In 1903, Andrew Carnegie made a statement in support of the libraries he was building across the nation. He said, "A library outranks any other one thing a community can do to benefit its people. It is a never-failing spring in the desert." So how does one stimulate education and creativity and innovative thinking across an entire nation? Well, in the 1880s, in a country that was just emerging from the destruction of the Civil War, one answer to that was to build a network of libraries that could deliver the latest knowledge across great distances to a very disconnected population. A great deal of that network was constructed by Andrew Carnegie. From 1883 until 1929, Carnegie donated funds to communities all across the country, and they constructed 2,509 Carnegie libraries. By the end of this project, the Carnegie libraries were 50% of all of the libraries in the country. The functions of these libraries were similar to many of those that we now access largely via the internet. They were local hubs for knowledge collection, dissemination, and consumption. They tied the community together, both by filling needs for outside information and entertainment, and by serving as both meeting places for groups and a quiet place of contemplation for individuals. Everyone came to the library at some point, just like everybody comes to the internet today. One of those nodes of knowledge was erected in my hometown in 1908. It stood as the grandest building in the entire county for more than 60 years. When I was 13 years old, I found a particular kind of refuge there. 13-year-old boys generally have few worries once released from their school day, and they can look forward to cruising around town on a stylish Stingray bicycle, followed by a little homework and maybe some television. But the trip home from school was not always easy. As an eighth grader, I picked up a new tormentor. Marcus and his nameless sidekick seemed to appear out of nowhere, demanding to know how much money I had and suggesting that it would be best for me if I handed it over. This must have been the early steps in Marcus's criminal career, because he had chosen a very poor target. I rarely had any money at all. A good day would yield a dime or a quarter, but most of the time, nothing at all. The first day I escaped with a warning and a punch in the arm, but there was a second day, and a third day, and a fourth day, and it became a regular pattern to be accosted for money, mildly beaten on my way home from school. The library provided a solution to my Marcus problem. One day, instead of heading toward home after school, I made my way to the impressive steps and columns of the Carnegie Library. Marcus would be waiting two blocks further on, wondering what had happened to his easy mark. I climbed the steps and entered the library's cool, musty common area. I had only been there once or twice previously, and so knew very little about what lay inside. I browsed the shelves looking for something to read. There may have been serious books on astronomy, physics, chemistry, history, or business, but I was 13. I gravitated toward the treasure trove of novels that were not available in the local drugstore, which was the de facto literary hub in a town of 9,000 people. I found the works of Edgar Rice Burroughs, Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, and Robert Heinlein. These stories opened a world of adventure and heroism and a fantastic future, a future set in a frame of solid, real science. While reading about space travel in Clarke novels, I learned about the physics of rockets and the classification system for stars, and I gained a sense for the immensity of the universe. Burroughs presented heroes with high morals, integrity, and bravery in the face of danger. Nowhere else was the world colored with such grand promise. But as significant as these ideas were, what I most remember is the quiet. I had stumbled into a refuge from the commonplace chatter of a small town, which formed a different kind of network for circulating smaller and more self-centered ideas, usually less noble and less deeply considered than those in the books. Within those walls, there were no interruptions. There were no friends eager for attention, no loudspeaker announcements, no sounds of construction, no demands for my attention. There was just nothing to do but read in silence, listen to the words. The library time became part of my daily routine. Go to school, then spend an hour in the library, and then head out to more typical activities. The library provided much more than just a shelter from a bully. Carnegie libraries provided refuge and connection for generations of people right up to the 21st century. Even as radio and television competed for control of news and entertainment, libraries remained the repositories of knowledge and inspiration. Much of that changed with the internet, which captured both a huge portion of that knowledge and almost all of the attention of a generation. So many writers have pointed to the internet's usurpation of the roles once filled by television, radio, and printed books that has become a cliche. But few have noted the demise of that old knowledge hub, the library, the place where contemplation and concentration were possible, where quiet study could connect a young reader to a wide world of ideas. Today, the World Wide Web, Wikipedia, YouTube, and digital books bring a flood of information to the eyes, ears, and fingertips of anyone who wants it, exactly when and where they want it. Much of the information is delivered in small, quick bites. Web surfers dart from one little nugget of knowledge to the next, resisting the tedium of digging deeper. There's no longer a physical place for quiet, uninterrupted reflection. Libraries remain special places. They're dedicated to storing and distributing knowledge, but often no one is there to see them anymore. They're forgotten jewels. For some, they're relics of a past era. In this connected age, it appears that innovative ideas are born of mass connectivity via email, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, Snapchat, WhatsApp, and a host of other platforms. Learning and inspiration are now all about sharing. Connectivity has become the dominant lifestyle and work style. It's the medium through which idea generation and innovation are being conducted now and into the foreseeable future. Knowledge is no longer retrieved from a repository. It's generated in and by the network. But even in this age when no idea seems born of a single thinker, I cling to the habits that I learned in the quiet of that library decades ago. When it is time to explore a subject in depth or to write a meaningful article, I retreat to a quiet room and banish interruptions. I work diligently, but with patience. Deep knowledge and understanding take time to form from many pieces passing through my mind. Mere access to information is not sufficient for deep thinking. It also requires focus and isolation of the mind. Great ideas do not emerge fully formed after scanning a few pages. Engaging with ideas requires thinking through the same ideas multiple times, as well as enduring through periods of thinking nothing at all. The place for this kind of thinking may never again be an elegant building fronted by inspiring columns and populated with paper books. When every book and document is accessible on a personal device, it becomes the responsibility of the reader to find or construct a refuge from interruption, a space for deep thought. The physical space may be a coffee shop, a park bench, or a home office. Wherever it is, it must offer escape from the constant stream of electronic interruptions. When physical isolation was equal to mental isolation, libraries offered a quiet place to think. Now that information interruption are delivered together through the same device and often in the same application, thinkers must create new means of seclusion. Just as the problem is technological, there may be a partial technological solution. Electronic devices already come with an airplane mode. Perhaps they also need a library or a deep thinking mode, a setting that allows access to information but blocks interruptions. But the responsibility now lies with each of us to create the isolation, the quiet that we need to absorb and sort information, to acquire real knowledge, and to create new ideas. One warm day, I rode my bicycle to the grassy lawn of the Carnegie Library and watched as bulldozers destroyed the classic building to clear the land for a new city government complex. After standing on that spot for 68 years, the bricks, columns, masonry, and concrete steps crumbled and fell into heaps. Thank you, Marcus, for driving me into the safety of that library and the inspiration that it offered. Your bullying lasted only a few months, but the habits of reading, learning, and quiet thought have stayed with me for a lifetime. They have been a cornerstone of my lifestyle that I value and struggle to preserve in the information age. Without you, I might not have found this spring in the desert. Where is your spring in the noisy desert today? How do you find the quiet that you need to explore new ideas and think deeply?